We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both formerly with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover this week, more than usual, actually, starting with the Arctic drilling and Seattle's role in all of that.
Yeah. Excuse me. This week, Mayor Ed Murray announced that the Port of Seattle has to get a new permit to host the Shell Oil drilling fleet at Terminal 5 in Seattle. He said, and the Department of Planning and Community Development backed him up, that the port has to reapply. Since the current permit doesn't cover allowing oil drilling equipment to berth there, the current permit is for loading and unloading cargo from container ships, says nothing at all about oil rigs or other oil drilling equipment. Shell said that, or Foss Maritime, which is leasing the Terminal 5 or a large portion of Terminal 5 from the Port of Seattle, said that they believe their lease covers that. And Shell said that in their negotiations with Foss Maritime that they were under the assumption that the Foss lease covers that, and Foss says that they're going to be standing by their lease. So it looks right now like Shell Oil is going to defy the city of Seattle and come in and berth there, regardless of whether or not the port has the proper permit from the city of Seattle. Now, Shell.
I smell a court proceeding.
Yes. Now, Shell wants to drill for oil in the Chukchi Sea up in Alaska this summer, and its oil rigs are scheduled to arrive here a little over a week from now. I believe the mooring date is Monday, the 18th.
That's correct. And there's also plenty of activists.
Yes, there are.
There's activist plans to try and physically block it, and there's also a lawsuit already in the courts to try and block it as well. And now the city and Foss Maritime, it would be Foss rather than Shell Oil that would be the subject of any kind of injunction, since Foss is the contractor. Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably going to be in the courts in the next week as well.
Yeah, because there's certainly not enough time for them to apply for and get a new permit between now and next Monday.
Hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Let's city releasing an environmental impact statement.
Yes, the city announced that it had released its environmental impact statement on the third arena in SoDo, the arena that's backed by Chris Hansen, hedge fund manager. The environmental impact statement found no problems with building a third arena in the same neighborhood in Seattle, south of downtown. Now, the EIS estimated that a total of about 72,500 people would attend events on a busy day when all three arenas are in use. But I should point out that that's about the total number of people who go to a sold-out Seahawks game in CenturyLink Field. So I think that's vastly undercounting the number of people who would be using all three arenas.
The actual capacity of the three arenas combined would be, doing the quick math, about 150,000, 140,000, somewhere in there.
I think at a minimum.
Yeah. And so the question then becomes, well, how many of those people are traveling together coming to the arena? And the chances, especially given the price of tickets, that a lot of those people are coming solo is pretty high. So it seems like a vast underestimate to me.
Yeah. And, you know, there are other hurdles that the arena has to clear. Now, most of the backers of the arena have admitted at this point that they're not likely to get an NBA team first into the arena. The city council is going to have to vote this summer, probably by September, to close a portion of Occidental Avenue South in order for arena construction to go ahead. And they're not likely to do that unless there's a better agreement on the table, a better funding package, one in which the city is not required to put up half the cost of the arena by issuing bonds. The current memorandum of understanding says that the arena will go ahead if the backers have an NBA team to go in and an NHL team. Currently, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, very recently, just in the last couple of weeks, said that he had doubts about whether Chris Hansen was up for committing to getting an NHL team in there first. And that could sink the arena altogether, because as soon as Bettman said that, the city of Tukwila came forward and put out their own proposal for an NHL facility to be built down there. And last week, they applied for an environmental impact study for that arena.
A couple of additional things on that. The current memorandum of understanding expires next year. So in addition to...
Actually, I think it's 2017.
Is it 17? Okay.
Yeah, early 2017.
But in any event, it's coming up quickly, certainly more quickly than the city can get a team in, particularly since there are no NBA or NHL teams currently up for sale that are likely prospects for relocation. So something like that generally doesn't happen that quickly. In that case, you're looking at who is going to be on city council after this year, and you're looking at what kind of demands there would be to renegotiate the memorandum of understanding, something that a number of council people and people in
and
City Hall have already talked about.
Yeah.
So it looks like they're going to be starting from ground zero. The other thing about the environmental impact statement, because it doesn't do a good job of, or certainly open for question, job of estimating traffic and estimating the impact on freight mobility, a number of the unions down in SOTO, on the working waterfront, who have been in opposition to SOTO Arena from the get-go, are likely to legally challenge that environmental impact statement, and that also is going to throw up roadblocks.
And the port may also challenge it as well. They've been making a lot of noises about how this environmental impact study that was done for the arena has not been taking into account their concerns at all.
Yeah, so it's a project that looks to be in trouble on several fronts right now.
Yeah, and you know, the Tukwila Arena, it has a timeline that shows that they could have it finished by the end of 2017, you know, before even the third arena in SOTO could get started.
All right. Moving on, city council hearing this week regarding the police tactics on May Day.
Yeah, it looks like it's an election year because Bruce Harrell, who was very much in opposition to police reforms last year, brought SPD in for some very sharp questioning, joined by retiring council member Nick Licata, of their actions on May Day. Now, May Day was portrayed in much of the media as, to use the SPD's term, a full-scale riot, where unruly black bloc anarchists went and destroyed property, etc. But a lot of video evidence that came out at the time and since then suggests that it was the police that instigated the riot rather than the protesters.
What the protesters had been saying.
Yes, all along. And that the protesters were actually doing rather innocuous things when the police literally attacked them. In particular, an incident on Broadway where protesters were linking arms, marched down the streets, and bicycle cops literally tried to mow down that entire line and attacked them, and what wound up being a scrum where officers were throwing protesters to the ground, essentially. And that's really when things got pretty messy and led to the shall we say, difficulties of the rest of the evening. That video was in use in the city council hearing on Wednesday, and Harrell and Licata questioning SPD on why they had used those tactics. Also, the excessive use of blast balls, tear grenades, flashbangs, whatever you want to call them. SPD was defending that by saying that they had probable cause to arrest one of the people who was in that row because he had thrown a traffic cone at a police officer who was essentially not hurt by that because it missed. And it really underscored that the police had come in fully armed with all these flashbangs and all the rest of it and looking for a fight. And
it's kind of interesting that our brand new chief of police stood behind them fully.
That's where I was going next. Yeah,
yeah.
That Kathleen O'Toole, who has really been the hope for a lot of people hoping to see a different culture at SPD, has come out fully backing the police officers' events. And, to some degree, people have been cutting her slack because of the opposition to police reforms within the ranks and recognizing that she needs to navigate that and be able to not only defend her officers but protect herself against internal politics, which is one reason why she's essentially cleaned house in terms of the different assistant chiefs. They're all her people now. Mm-hmm. But her response to this has been pretty discouraging.
I think an interesting thing about this whole event, too, is that the Seattle police spokesman who was there at the Wednesday hearing said that the new use of force board is reviewing all of the incidents where police used different things like tear gas and flashbang grenades and so forth. and they're going to be tallying them up and reviewing whether or not they were excessive uses of force. So we'll see if that new new board actually works, or if it's just another show to sort of appease the community.
All right, and somewhat related to this, it appears that there's a new OPA in town, and it's run by citizens.
Yeah, the Office for Professional Accountability, which is the structure that SPD and the city have had in place, which actually doesn't investigate SPD, doesn't hold SPD accountable, has no authority to depose officers or
although to
or
be
take
fair, some members of that group have tried.
Yes. But their power is very limited. Yeah, all they can really do is review the police internal investigations and say whether the thing was adequate or not. And widely has been seen in past years as kind of a rubber stamp for a lot of those investigations. A story in The Stranger today about two IT guys, both of whom have had personal incidents where they were wrongfully arrested. As a result, started a group, Center for Open Policing, acronym COP, that has been doing the OPA's work for it. What they've been doing is doing open records requests of video from different incidents, and they've amassed this enormous database of video from the years 2011 to 2013, because, as it turns out, the SPD destroys all of that evidence after 3 years. And so they've been going through and tallying problematic incidents and trying to line up how that tallies with citizen complaints against individual officers. And one of their findings is that of the 11 officers who have had the most complaints lodged against them, every single one of them is still actively on the street and on the force. Another interesting part of that is that virtually all of the officers that are on the street, and all told about 1,000 of the 1,800 or so employees of SPD, that includes civilian employees, have had at least one complaint against them lodged by the public. Granted, a lot of complaints are spurious, but the number of complaints that are actually upheld by SPD is right around 1%. 99% of them are dismissed. And for anybody familiar with statistics, it's almost impossible to get 99% of anything. It's a very, very small number that are actually upheld. So, and they've got this enormous database that they're just beginning to go through in terms of identifying problematic officers and such. This is the sort of thing that a civilian oversight board should be doing, could be doing very easily, and instead two members of the public with IT skills and day jobs,
young techie guys,
have taken it upon themselves to do it instead. It really underscores the kind of oversight that the city needs, but has been completely uninterested in pursuing.
And one of those guys being Phil Mosek, who has been on our show multiple times before.
Yes.
So, way to go, Phil. Moving on, a gun lobby lawsuit?
Yes, a U.S. District Court judge threw out a lawsuit this week against I-594. That's the background checks for gun purchases at gun shows or online. That passed in November with an almost 60% vote from voters.
Statewide.
Now, statewide, yeah. Judge Benjamin Settle ruled that the plaintiffs, pro-gun groups like the Second Amendment Foundation, had no standing and couldn't show that the law would cause them any harm. He said that the plaintiffs, quote, alleged threat of prosecution is not genuine, end quote, which really matches up with a lot of the rhetoric that comes out of these pro-gun groups about how any time there are any controls placed on the use or the sale and purchase of guns or the type of guns you can have, then therefore the government is going to take all of our weapons away from us, throw us in prison, torture us, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and very specifically, the rhetoric that was used to oppose I-594 last year talked about, for example, if there's a private sale between two individuals, you can't even borrow somebody's gun or you'll be thrown in jail, et cetera.
And that's not true.
A lot of those claims were challenges not being true by 594's advocates last year. And what we have here here essentially is a court ruling saying, yeah, the people who opposed 594, their claims essentially were ridiculous,
that they
had no standing at all. And so clearly what they need is somebody who does have standing, namely a crazy person with felony records, in order to bring a lawsuit that they can't get their gun, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah. which case the judge might rule, I think the law was written specifically for you, buddy.
Exactly.
All right. Moving on, a big ruling this week regarding NSA phone collection.
Yeah. A three-judge panel of the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan ruled that the NSA's bulk data collection is against the law and has not been authorized by Congress, and that the provision that they've been using in the USA Patriot Act to provide cover for their bulk data collection is not suitable for that purpose. But they went ahead and allowed the program to continue, the judges did, temporarily continue, acknowledging that there are two upcoming events. One would be that Congress is going to be voting fairly soon on a bill to either renew or replace the USA Patriot Act, which expires on June 1st, and also that this lawsuit will almost certainly be appealed by the government, and that the lawsuit will eventually end up before the Supreme Court. Now, the U.S. House of Representatives, I talked about this last week, has passed a bill that could end bulk data collection and storage by the government. It would put bulk data collection in the hands of private telecom companies, like phone companies, so think about whether or not you think that's better for privacy reasons.
Oh, yeah, they trust them way more.
Yeah. But Senate leaders are pushing for an across-the-board renewal of the USA Patriot Act with no changes, although there is a bipartisan group, a fairly large bipartisan group in the Senate, who introduced a bill exactly like the House bill. And that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. We'll see what happens
and that's,
there.
That's specifically a division within the Republican leadership and the Republican Party in the House and the Senate between libertarians and people who are all for more and more government surveillance. So we'll see how that conflict plays out.
And I should also point out, too, that if the House bill is the one that gets passed, the FBI and the NSA and other government intelligence agencies would still have access to your phone data. They just wouldn't be able to grab it without an order from the FISA court.
Yeah. And even if they were specifically barred by law from doing it, that's no guarantee they wouldn't do it
anyway. That they wouldn't find a way around it.
All right. Also this week, the Department of Justice announcing that it's going to be looking into what happened in Baltimore.
Yeah,
some interesting developments in Baltimore. First off, the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, asked the U.S. Department of Justice to initiate a civil rights investigation into the Baltimore Police Department. This was this was early in the week. A little bit later in the week, Loretta Lynch, the brand new U.S. Attorney General of the United States, she visited Baltimore and met with community leaders, politicians, and religious leaders.
And police officers.
Them, yes, and she asked them, anybody here, would you object to the Department of Justice doing an investigation of the Baltimore Police Department? And apparently not a single person that she talked to was against it. So that was very interesting. So, of course, at the end of the week on Thursday, the spokesman from the U.S. Department of Justice came out and said, yes, we are initiating an investigation into the practices of the Baltimore Police Department. So that is some very good news that has come out of the whole mess in Baltimore.
Yeah, although one caution is that Lynch, both before and during and after her confirmation and her new tenure, and she'd only been sworn in less than a week before all this happened this week, but she has talked repeatedly about having a less confrontational relationship between the Department of Justice and local law enforcement agencies. So this will be a test as to whether the Department of Justice under Lynch is going to be as assertive as it was under Holder in trying to hold local law enforcement accountable.
Yeah, I should point out, too, that one of the officials she asked and who agreed with her on an investigation was the police commissioner of Baltimore. So, yeah, she is going to be a bit more attentive to police department personnel than Eric Holder was.
All right. Also, developments this week in Cleveland?
Yeah, Cleveland may be the next Baltimore in terms of events that happen this month, this coming month. They're bracing for a verdict on a trial that went to the judge because it's not a jury trial, it's a judge trial. He's expected to do his ruling in the next week and a half, for a verdict on a police officer named Michael Brillo for two counts of voluntary manslaughter in the 2012 deaths of two unarmed black suspects, Timothy Russell and Marissa Williams. Brillo stood on the hood of their car after a chase when the car had been stopped in a parking lot and shot 49 times into the car of about 137 shots fired by over a dozen Cleveland cops. Now, over two dozen of those shots hit each of the suspects, who were not surprisingly killed in the exchange, and as it turns out, they were completely unarmed at the time. Meanwhile, Cleveland,
you know, these kinds of incidents really remind me of kind of gangland warfare in Chicago during Prohibition, where they would mow each other down with machine guns. You know, I mean, you look at that and you go, 45 shots, 137 shots. My God,
were they using Tommy guns, or what was the deal?
What was the deal? I know, it's just amazing.
So, meanwhile, also in Cleveland, people are frustrated because the investigation into the death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, which that shooting happened last November, so that investigation is 6 months on, still with no indication of when the city of Cleveland will actually finish investigating an incident that was literally caught on video and has been seen by most of the country. It's pretty clear what happened, and yet that investigation has been dragged out. So there's a lot of tensions in Cleveland right now, another city where the Department of Justice is investigating the local police. In fact, they're now in their second go-round of a possible consent decree. That the community unrest that might happen there is something to watch out for in the next week or two. Both the mayor and the governor of Ohio have been issuing cautions of a concern about possible violence when a verdict is reached in the Brillo case.
All right. Moving on to international, and our friends up north in Alberta had an election this week.
Yeah,
a remarkable election. And speaking as somebody who's a dual Canadian citizen, is something that I've tracked a lot over the years, is the frustrations of the politics in Alberta. Now, Canadian provinces have a lot more autonomy than U.S. states do in terms of the province's relationship with the federal government in Ottawa. And the Alberta government, and of course, Alberta is where the tar sands are located, has been very, very much beholden to the energy industries, and very aggressive in their promotion of tar sands with the Conservative Party that has led there for over 40 years, until this week when the New Democratic Party, which is the Canadian Socialist Party, swept elections in Alberta, which is sort of like the Green Party taking over in Texas. Yeah. It's a remarkable development.
They took over 60% of the seats in the Alberta provincial legislature, which is just a landslide for them.
When they've
always had third-party status.
Yeah,
there.
They in the past have only had, like, you know, 10 seats maybe.
Yeah.
So a caution on this, that the NDP in Alberta, very similar to Social Democratic and Green parties in Europe, isn't necessarily that good on questions like tar sands and pipelines. They're still very pro energy industry, but they are a little bit more cautious and a little less aggressive in promoting it and promoting pipelines. They're talking about sending the oil east rather than promoting the Keystone XL pipeline, which would send it south, or a couple of the proposed pipelines, which would go west into BC. And they're also a little bit more environmentally sensitive, but they're still very much interested in mining the tar sands, which is the big problem in the first place.
Yeah, and they're also, I find kind of interesting, they're also very pro-corporate tax. So they've said that they're looking at raising corporate taxes in Alberta.
Which have historically been extremely low.
Yeah, looking at reforming the amount of royalties that oil companies pay to the Alberta government in order to extract oil from the tar sands. So that's kind of interesting, I find. But overall, they're not necessarily as good for the environment as people might think. But it is good news for us here in the West, since they appear to not be supportive of the Northern Gateway pipeline, which would go from Alberta through British Columbia and be an enormous risk for the environment of British Columbia.
Yeah. Meanwhile, here I'd be thrilled if we could get 10 seats for a third party. the state or
in the Washington state legislature. Yeah.
All right. And then finally, in international this week, a U.S. airstrike hitting and killing civilians.
Yeah. May 1st. And the reports have just been filtering out into the West since then. A U.S. airstrike erroneously hitting a non-combatant village in northern Syria in Aleppo province, killing 53 civilians, including 7 children. Now, of course, the U.S. military denying and lying as usual. The quote from a U.S. Military spokesman saying, we currently have no information to corroborate allegations that coalition airstrikes resulted in civilian casualties. That from Major Kurt Kellogg, who is a spokesman for the U.S. Central Command. Now, the phrase, we currently have no information to corroborate allegations, that's 4 weasel words in the first 8 words of that statement, which is standard practice in these kind of issues is that a couple months from now, the U.S. military will say, oh, by the way, that thing that happened last May, yeah, we did kill all those people. Sorry about that. But the more interesting part of that is, even though you have had massive loss of life in this, massive loss of life of people who had nothing really to do with the Syrian civil war, U.S. media has shown absolutely no interest in this story at all. It's gotten quite a bit of play in British and European press, but almost none in the U.S., which again underscores the fact that the U.S. government and the Obama administration continue to kill civilians and non-combatants in a number of different parts of the world with virtually no domestic visibility at all. It's just being ignored.
And when they do recognize it and they offer compensation later, as they did with people in, I'm not sure whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, they offer like $1,000 to $1,500 per family member who is killed.
Yeah, now you know what prices go for.
That doesn't help when your entire family is wiped out, as has happened in the past.
Events.
Big one coming up this evening, what's shaping up to be a fairly large rally at Westlake at 6 o'clock for the Black Lives Matter movement, a solidarity march for what has happened in Baltimore and with the death of Freddie Gray and other local things around the country that continue to percolate, like the issues in Cleveland that I talked about. That'll be at 6 o'clock tonight at Westlake Park in 4th and Pine in downtown Seattle.
And then also today from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. is the Oh Shall Know Nonviolent Direct Action Training at University Temple United Methodist Church for folks who will be taking part in the anti-Shell demonstrations coming up next weekend when the Shell oil rigs will be trying to dock at Terminal 5. University Temple United Methodist Church is at 1415 Northeast 43rd Street in the U District. And if you just want a general nonviolence training, those 4 hours can be very useful for you.
Yeah, also, highly recommended.
Yes, also on Tuesday the 12th is Pack the Port Tuesday at Pier 69 at 1 p.m. at the Port of Seattle headquarters at 2711 Alaskan Way. Go there and tell them that they really need to revoke Foss Maritime's lease. So that Shell oil equipment will not be able to dock at Terminal 5. And then, of course, next weekend there will be a whole host of events around Shell attempting to dock at Terminal 5. Saturday is the Shell No Flotilla from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. from Seacrest Marine Park at 1660 Harbor Avenue Southwest, where you can rent a kayak or bring your own and go out on the water to protest the Shell rig. And then, of course, the following Monday on the 18th is You Shall Not Pass, a nonviolent, I emphasize nonviolent, mass direct action starting at 7 a.m. at the Duwamish River floating dock on Harbor Island. That's on the east side of the island.
We'll be talking about that a whole lot more next week, I'm sure.
Yeah.